Okay, Ken, continuing now. After you have gone through the operation swap and you've gone into the new squadron and you are getting ready to ship out, did you have time with your families before you left country?
Not very much. We got back and it was, I might have had a month at home or at the most two or something like that, but it was pretty much, as I recall, it was pretty much I got back and we were in training to go on cruise, and so I was away most of the time from then on.
What do you tell your family? I know we talked about what you and Sandy discussed, but what do you tell your children? How do you handle knowing that you're leaving, you're going on this cruise, you will be flying in combat in a war? How do you handle that situation with you?
Well, I just tried to explain that it's important for our country, and Daddy's mission was to do what the country had asked him to do. Just very matter-of-factly that Dad had to do a job, and my job was to go fight if the country said go fight. And since I had a supportive wife, I really didn't have any. No problems with the children. They were very young, of course, but in fact, Kenny hadn't been born yet. But Annalise was just little and didn't really understand anything about the complications of things like that.
Okay. Well, tell me about that cruise aboard the Roosevelt, and this is
Well, it was
1966.
interesting one. We hit Rio de Janeiro on the way across. We went around the Cape and came up that way, and went right into started down in South Vietnam, as I recall, and sort of working with FACS, our Air Force FACS primarily, some ground control FACS, and spent I think about 2 weeks down there, and then we. That was called Dixie Station in those days,
Yes.
and then moved up to Yankee Station, which is up in the off North Vietnam,
Right.
and then prosecuted the war from that point on. Missions were basically very much like the in A6s later on, which I described. You brief 2 hours before the hop, which included a brief in the ready room about how you're going to join up, what your individual squadron activity was going to be in the air, and then you met with the air wing down in a CVIC, which was the sort of like a controlled space where they could do classified briefings. And we got a brief on the weather, we got a brief on enemy defenses and the big target, if it was going to be a major target or if it was going to be individuals. Usually the section leader or division leader would go down, division being normally four planes, section 2 planes, would go down to, the leader would go down to CBIC and pick up all the information, and he'd come back to the ready room. And as I recall, they had, I think in those days we had a weather briefing over the TV, a closed circuit TV system that was broadcast to each of the ready rooms. And the weatherman would give you a brief, and then everybody else would get ready to go. Then you'd suit up about a half an hour prior to, strap on all your survival equipment, and man your airplanes.
Can you tell me what your uniform consisted of? What was your survival equipment,
Well, in
et
those
cetera?
days, we didn't have the green Nomex. Flight suits. We only had orange flight suits. So when combat came, before the green Nomex flight suits came out, we dressed in fatigues. So we had like Marine fatigues on, and we had torso harness, a G suit, which covered the legs, and it had big pockets, and we stuffed them with survival equipment and things that we might need if we were downed. Extra bottles of water, little bottles of water, and things like that. And then we had a vest, a survival vest that went over the torso harness. And the torso harness is where your parachute is strapped to, so that if when you eject, you've got a full laced parachute harness, if you will, and a helmet. I picked up a big survival knife in the GEST, which is Jungle Escape and Survival Training at QB Point. And these Negritos that were indigenous Indian group from in the Philippines were excellent in the jungle. They lived in the jungle. They knew the jungle really well. And the Navy employed them to teach us how to survive in the jungle. And they used to make these machetes. They were shortened versions of a machete out of Jeep springs from World War II.
Wow.
And they were really good metal and everything, and they sharpened real well, and they were kind of heavy, so they could cut through the brush and everything. So,
right.
So I bought one of those, and I had one of the parachute riggers make me a scabbard that would attach to my leg, and I carried that for the whole, for all my years over there.
Okay.
So it was quite a bit of gear. Oh, plus we were issued, let's see, VA 42. We got the first 9mm pistols, automatic pistols that were issued over there. We had a very inventive survival officer.
Officer.
He was Dave Griggs was his name. He was later an astronaut and was killed in an aircraft accident, a pleasure aircraft accident. But he was really a hard go-getter and a neat person, a bachelor, and he had all kinds of time. And he talked to the skipper and said, "We got to do this and we do that." And the skipper said, "Go out and do it." So he got lugs on our aviation shoes, the jungle type lugs, soles, and he got all kinds of other things. And he also somehow arranged that we would be the first issued of the 9mm gun. So we carried that, extra ammo, signal flares, all that kind of stuff.
Okay. How much do you think you would weigh with all that equipment on?
Oh, probably extra 40 pounds or thereabouts.
Okay. And was it comfortable inside the aircraft with all that?
Well, we were seated, so it wasn't uncomfortable to have all this stuff on. You get used to having the bulk on you. It was just, it didn't detract much from flying the airplane.
Okay. Ken, you said the first 2 weeks you were down south, flying.
I believe it was 2 weeks.
Okay. This was close air support, basically?
Right. You were just getting adjusted to working with FACS and working with the ground FACS. We supported some of the operations, and it was very interesting because we got to see a little bit of what was going on down in the south.
Right. This is your first taste of wartime combat.
Right. That was nothing at all. That was like going to the target range.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You
didn't feel you were getting shot at. They might have been shooting something up at you, but it definitely wasn't AAA.
Right.
In the sense that we got when we were up in north.
Right.
You couldn't see anything that they were firing at you. It was all a small arms fire if they fired at you at all. They fired at the FACS more than they fired at us.
Right.
They were a lot lower.
Right.
So they took all the abuse.
Can you describe what a bomb run was like when you would do that
down
south?
Well, we were pretty well versed in what we call 45-degree dive angle. And our release speed was around 500 knots. We start out at about 10,000 feet and release at supposedly 5,500 feet. And you had a pipper, which is a gunsight device that gave you a mil lead on your bomb. So say the bomb had a trajectory drop of 15 mils or 25 mils, you crank that in and that would allow you to be beyond the target so that the bomb drop lead would allow you to get bombed basically on target.
Okay.
But it was fairly easy. They would, the FACS would sit up there and they would shoot a phosphorus rockets at the target. And then when the phosphorus would go off, they'd say, okay, the target is 15 feet or two clicks to the right or to the north or whatever. They'd give you some kind of description of where the target that you were supposed to bomb was from the spot that they had fired at. So then you'd go over there, and mostly we were dropping into jungle or what rice paddies or something like that. So you didn't, from 10,000 feet, you couldn't see much.
Right.
It was just a jungle down there, and so you'd watch for the spot, and then you'd, depending on how much time you had on station, you'd either drop one or two bombs at a time, or if you were running out of time, you could drop your whole load all at one pass. But usually it was better to drop one bomb at a time or one or two bombs at a time, because then they could adjust your fire. You could say, okay, well, your hit was a little bit short, and just, you know, and then you'd put another two bombs in a little bit further on, and made it easy, made it proper, better for them, and I think we got better hits.
So they could literally direct you?
Yes, they would. They would direct us.
Could you see what you were hitting?
No, most of the time not.
Okay.
Because these guys were in the jungle and or dug in foxholes or bunkers or something. Couldn't see them.
I assume the facts would also tell you, okay, yeah, good shot, that got exactly
right. They pump us up a lot by saying, oh, yeah, you really got him, or yeah, you're... And then when we went out, they'd always give us a after-action report, and they'd say, okay, 100% of your bombs were in the target area, 50% were within 15 meters of the target, which is basically a target kill, because the bomb's going off with the shock and everything else would probably kill anybody who was on the ground. They'd say, hey, you didn't do very well, guys. Come up back tomorrow and work again or something, you know. But basically, we were pretty good bombers, so I think the Navy, the facts liked working with the Navy guys.
Right.
At least that was my impression.
How many of you would fly out to do these certain runs?
Well, let's say that every launch we would launch, we had 3 A4 squadrons and 2 F4 squadrons.
Mm-hmm.
F4s were basically, they weren't too good at bombing. And they tried, but they weren't really all that good at it.
Why not?
Well, first of all, they trained to be air-to-air.
Okay.
The basic job is to go kill airplanes. So they thought this dropping bombs was kind of working class business. not their kind of stuff.
Right.
And they didn't practice a lot of that. And we practiced day in and day out bombing. And we had contests within the squadron. We kept track of, you know, who was the best bomber and who's the second best bomber. And it was a matter of pride to try to get better and better so that you could be the best.
Sure.
And the fighters guys didn't, that wasn't their mission prior to Vietnam. And number two, they weren't terribly wild about pointing their nose at the ground. Their job was to go kill airplanes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where did you typically rank, Ken, on the bombing scale?
Yeah, pretty close to the top.
Uh-huh. Okay. So after you finished down...
I always felt I was a good bomber.
I'm sorry?
I always felt I was a good bomber.
Yeah. After you finish down south, you go up to Yankee Station, and your mission changes quite a bit.
Oh, you were asking me how many... Okay, I was trying to get back to explaining. Okay, so we have three flights of, say, four A4s, and depending on the need for the different facs, they would send us to different facs, or they might send us all to one, and then you would hang around in a kind of like a orbit over the target, and each section each division would work together. Then they were finished, and next division would go in and work. And the third one, et cetera. Or they might go to three different separate facs and work one division apiece.
Right.
So it varied from day to day.
Okay. When you go up north,
right,
things change quite a bit as far as your mission and,
right,
and operations, and the danger increased significantly.
Right.
Describe what your basic mission was flying over North Vietnam, and tell me about
the same
incidents.
Briefing. Format would go on about 2 hours, and then you'd man up and then fly the mission. We were on 1.45 cycle, meaning that the longest you'd be in the air would be about 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our missions, there are two types of mission, one which were called recce missions, they're armed recce. The other was a designated target before you left the ship. Obviously, the more critical the target, the bigger the strike they put on it. including a full air wing strike, which meant about 35 aircraft going in on one target.
Hmm.
And that included fighter support, include jamming support, electronic jamming,
mm-hmm.
and include the bombers.
It's quite a bit of air power.
Yeah, a lot of air power, and it could be generated. We could generate three, what we used to call alpha strikes. That was the major strikes, alpha strikes, about three of those a day.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of force coming ashore at any one given time.
Yes.
Or we would run 12-hour cycles, which meant essentially every hour and a half there was a new inborn raid, but those were usually 12 A-4s, maybe six F-4s,
mm-hmm.
and then a few jammers and tankers and things like that, support aircraft. And they would be going in every hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was called cyclic ops. And those normally were light target areas, or they were armed recce, which meant they would give you a road segment to reconnaissance, mm-hmm. make a reconnaissance on, and you would go along, fly along this road segment and look for targets of opportunity,
mm-hmm.
trucks, or look like fuel, places where they stored fuel, or little small bridges, or when they bombed a big bridge, they'd always make bypasses around it, and you'd bomb some of those areas, and you could sometimes get a good hit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about attacking the city areas?
Well, that's usually when we used alpha strikes. And,
uh-huh.
Of course, if we went up to Haiphong or Hanoi, those were big strikes, and they required a lot of support, which included Iron Hand, which I'll talk about in a minute. But
okay.
The strikes were... usually a point target or a series of targets in a small locality.
Okay.
And you'd go up there and you'd work them over, but they'd fight back hard,
mm-hmm.
including missile defenses, sometimes airstrikes. One of our first air wing losses was an A-4 that got shot down by a MiG.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't even know he was missing on the strike. I never even saw the guy.
Wow.
He just turned up missing. And later on, the intelligence added that a MiG went out and got him.
Huh.
But that was the job. That was supposed to be the job of the F-4s, to keep you safe from the MiGs.
Right.
And they did. Navy guys did a hell of a job, I must say. They were. I'm quite certain if you would ever get to talk to any of the Russians that flew or the North Vietnamese that flew, that they would agree that going after the Navy strike groups was the toughest challenge that they had.
Mm-hmm.
And the Air Force was easy in comparison.
Is that because of training, do you think?
I think it's training, absolutely. We were the best. We had the best fighters, trained fighters in the war. They had the best kill ratios. And they just couldn't wait to get a hold of a MiG. I mean, they were just salivating,
mm-hmm.
to be able to get one.
Mm-hmm.
And they did very well.
Could you describe... what a typical mission would be like when you describe those different kinds of missions? Could you kind of walk us through?
Okay, well, the first one, let's say an armed recce, that would be probably two guys would go out together. If a squadron, like VA-72, we'd have four planes going out that particular mission cycle, we would probably have two and two. We'd have two different sections.
Mm-hmm.
And they would prosecute, and they'd fly. One guy would fly fairly low. We weren't supposed to fly below 3,500 feet because of the small arms fire, and the chances of getting shot down increased a great deal more at that going below 3,500 feet. So we, what we call jink, which would be lightly weaving back and forth across the road,
mm-hmm.
always changing your direction, always changing your altitude a little bit. The other guy would stay behind him and high, a little bit higher, and watch out for him, watch his tail for MiGs, watch for... He might see having the advantage of height. He might see AAA sights that the guy low was concentrating on the road wouldn't see. So his job was sort of to also look for targets, but also to keep an eye on number one and to protect him and to make sure that we weren't getting jumped by somebody, or
mm-hmm.
Or maybe he would see AAA that the other guy couldn't see.
What would happen if a MiG came on the scene and you guys did not have the F4?
Well, we had the A4 had a small 20 mic. It mm-hmm. was a single cannon.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't terribly reliable, but I always felt with our training that we could avoid them. We wouldn't probably shoot them down, but we could hassle them and get away
mm-hmm.
and call in the fighters. I was never terribly worried about it. Just, you know, it'd be neat to see one, but I never did.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't terribly fearful of them, mainly because they did a slash and run attack, and that was it. They'd,
mm-hmm.
they'd come in real fast, and they'd try to hit you when you didn't see them. But,
mm-hmm.
but they wouldn't, most of them, the few that stayed around to fight usually never got back to Hanoi.
Yeah.
So they learned quickly. They made a slashing attack, and then they left because they didn't know where they were going to get hit from next.
These Russian pilots or Vietnamese
pilots?
Well,
we think
mainly.
They were. Some of them were.
Were Russian?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm not saying that they all were. I'm just saying that we know that the Russians had involvement
sure.
from intelligence sources.
Sure.
But we never knew who you were going after, whether you were going after a Russian or North Vietnamese.
Right. I guess it didn't particularly matter at the time.
No, it didn't. You don't even see the guy.
Yeah.
But, there were some good MiG pilots, and there were some terrible MiG pilots.
Mm-hmm.
Like in everything else, some of them survived the war, and some of them didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But if you make a critical mistake in that business, you're gonna pay for it.
Mm-hmm. So go ahead with
okay. Strike mission, a big one would be where you would form up over the ship normally. Because you have 35 airplanes that have to collect in basically the same airspace. And so you rendezvous over the ship if the weather allowed, different airspace. One squadron would be at 15,000 feet, another one would be 14, 13, 12. And they would orbit over the ship, and when they were all collected in their various four-plane divisions, then they would see they knew where what altitude the leader was on, and then when they got their guys together, they would go down and join on the lead division, and then the lead division would determine if he had enough airplanes, he would start heading for the beach. And so it was a navigation problem from then on, from the ship to the beach, and from the beach to the target. And you'd do a light, you'd stay at altitude probably 12,000 feet or thereabouts, and lightly weaving, the whole group would be doing their own thing within that huge cell, and they would move in. The fighters would go ahead and make a fighter sweep. Normally, they'd go in and circle around the whole group so that they could pick up anybody on their radars and protect the people that way. Then there would be a couple of fighters in the tail end, and they'd watch your rear. And then a thing called the Iron Hand would go in at their designated time, and an Iron Hand was a FAM suppression aircraft mission, and that included I was one of the nominated SAM guys, so I was designated Iron Hand man. And what we did was we carried Shrike missiles, and the Shrike at that time was a fairly new missile, and it was a anti-radiation missile. It homed in on the radar from the Fansong radar, which was directing the SA-2 missile.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd come up in their little consoles, turn on the radar, and we'd receive it, zero in on it, and fire the Shrike at it, and the Shrike would go down and home on the and blow up the trailer, which included all the radar gear.
Mm-hmm.
And so the missiles were ineffective, obviously, if it didn't have guidance. So it was kind of cat and mouse. After they found out we had those things, the North Vietnam, very smart to adapt, they didn't turn on their radar until they'd use other means of identifying the aircraft and pinpointing where they were, and then they'd almost have us in their sights, and then they'd turn on the Fansong just before they were ready to shoot. So we got to this cat and mouse game where we would orbit up over known areas of SAM sites and then wait for them to turn on the Fansong and just dive right at them. So they were firing at us while we were diving on them and firing these missiles, and it was kind of like a game of chicken. You figured he'd turn off his radar before he got killed in his radar trailer. And that's what they normally did. They were definitely afraid of it because it was accurate, very accurate. And then you'd, once you saw the where the strike went in, the explosion, you'd go down and you'd, we also carried 5-inch rockets. They were like a 5-inch shell, very, very powerful rockets. And so they would then we'd go in and hit the SAM site itself with those after we had fired the strike. So we sort of dove in, fired the strike, rearmed, climbed, and then dove in again on the smoke and the debris from the strike missile. And we were pretty effective, I think.
Yeah, okay. Were those the two main kind of missions then you flew, the armed recce and the...
Yeah, I was a big... most of the major strikes, I was an Iron Hand flyer.
Okay.
And the rest of them, I was doing recce.
Did you like the Iron Hand mission?
I really did. It was I learned how to fight the SA-2 missile because it had limitations. It was very big and it was very fast. And if you ever get up to Washington again, go to the they have the new aviation space annex.
Yes.
And there's a SA-2 missile in there, which I enjoyed seeing.
I bet that brings back some memories for
you. Yeah, it was. It was kind of neat.
Well,
but I really did, and I got a perverse kick out of fighting it because I felt that I could beat it, and so then I got it became kind of a cat and mouse thing, and I really enjoyed the thrill of going after those things.
Well, tell me about some incidents that happened during both kinds of missions that you experienced during this first cruise.
Well,
I know some
a lot of more
things.
Routine and pretty boring, but there was always. They were always shooting at you up there.
Right.
And you could see by the various colors of the tracers and the explosions of what kind of guns they were shooting at you, being 37 millimeter were usually kind of a gray puff. 57s and were a little bit darker. 85s were really bright orange. That was a huge gun, really. The 85 millimeter is it's a big, big weapon. And when it goes off, it makes a big explosion, and it's very orange, bright orange, and then, of course, turns black. But you could tell the different kinds, and then of course, the SAM missile SA-2s at that time. We didn't have anything else, which is fortunate, but I'm sure we would have had some kind of countermeasures or developed countermeasures to whatever they brought in. But at that time, we just had the SA-2s. So that was that. The danger of all the others, you knew that everybody that had a gun was shooting at you, whether they could hit you or not, because we picked up a lot of shrapnel. Not a lot, but occasionally you'd come back with a hole in your airplane, which you didn't even know you had.
Right.
And it was usually from some small caliber rifle or something that they just shot in mass. And so when you were over there, you knew you were getting shot at, even if you didn't see anything.
How did you feel getting shot at?
Well, it's pretty exciting, number one.
Okay.
And number two, you expect that was their job and we were doing ours. So you expected that's what was going to happen. It was no surprise because it wasn't nice when somebody went down, but, that was the price that you knew somebody had to pay.
Did you witness anybody getting shot down?
As a matter of fact, I did. One of the major raids that I was on, again, I was Iron Hand. I was coming out after firing strikes. We had been up in Hanoi area. And on the way back, I was coming out relatively low. But really, when we exited the target areas, we usually just put the throttle to the wall and jigged out of the area. And your adrenaline was going and all that stuff because you'd heard SAM missiles going off, you'd heard MIG calls, and you'd had all this other stuff, so it was an exciting period of your life, and so you'd finished your drop, you dropped your bombs, therefore you were light, your airplanes were light loaded, and you could really come out. Well, this one guy was above me, and he was a squadron mate. I know he's one of my airplanes, one of my squadron airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been a bomber, and I've been an Iron Hand, and he was coming out straight and level at about 2,000 feet above me, and I couldn't understand why it was straight and level. That's not what you try to do. Mm-hmm. And then we got a SAM call, and I got it on my gear.
What do you mean by a SAM call, Ken?
Well, they had electronic aircraft in the Gulf that were monitoring the electronic emissions coming out of North Vietnam.
Okay.
And they would say they were mostly used for the MIG calls, and they would say bullseye, which happened to be Hanoi, and they would say bandit activity 15 miles north of bullseye headed east,
okay,
or something like that. And they give you a running commentary where the MIGs were.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they had some other ELAND aircraft would come up and say, you got SAM warning, you know, or something like that. And they would tell you in the rough area that they had received a Samsung emission. And then our airplanes had warning gear inside of it. And we could tell, especially the Iron Hand aircraft, we could tell where it was coming from, the angle and all that stuff, of where the mission was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And we could turn to that mission, and then you could actually see the SA-2 launch. Sometimes you'd never got the warning. They would launch the missile and then turn on the fan song. So it was very, you know, the cat and mouse game. But this one, we heard the call, and I was looking for the SAM coming up, and it came up right, say, I was going to due east. Due east, and then the missile was coming from the Fan Hoa area, which is due south of us, and it was just coming right for this guy. And I called. I said I didn't know what his call sign was because I couldn't tell what side number. I was too far to read his side number, but I said, decoy, break now, Sam. And he didn't waver. He just was wings level.
Mm.
And he took the hit of the missile right, I was right below him when it went off. And it was just a tangle of massive explosion. And when it hits there, it's a real, real orangish explosion. Because that fuel, I guess the fuel in the SA-2 missile is very explosive, and of course, so it comes out of a very, very bright orange hit and explodes, and of course, the fuel in the airplane and everything else, so it was terribly on fire. I mean, just engulfed in flames, the whole airplane. And it spiraled to the ground, and I dove right down on it. I was spiraling down with the airplane as it collapsed into the ground, and there was no way that anybody could have gotten out of it, so I went back to the ship and told them that that our man was a goner. What I don't know to this day, but I speculate that he was injured. He'd been hit.
Okay.
And he was just trying to get out, and he was wings level, and he was just trying to get out.
Right.
But I'll never know that. But he wasn't moving at all. He wasn't weaving. He wasn't changing his course or anything else, and I think he was just almost on autopilot getting out and never made it.
Was that traumatic for you to be there and watch?
Yeah,
that?
It was pretty traumatic. I never lost any sleep over it, but I mean, it was one of those impressions that will never go away.
Mm-hmm.
Firmly indelible in my memory bank of, mm-hmm, of a guy meeting his maker.
Yeah. Ken, that brings up another issue. Did you experience fear when you flew these very dangerous missions?
No, I think you experience fear every day. And I don't think it was fear is ever present, you know, in something like that. But what the thing is to either not think about it, compartmentalize, which aviators are good at,
mm-hmm,
or just downplay it, or try to do something else, or think of something else, and not subject yourself to fear. But I know fear is ever present, and I'll give you an example of that. I won't mention the guy's name, but a four pilot in our squadron was hit on his first mission over there. He got a little piece of shrapnel in his airplane,
mm-hmm,
came back to the ship and was all right. Barely knew he was hit, but.
Mm-hmm.
But the experience was so unnerving to him that subsequent to that flight, he never went over the beach. And he would down his airplane during the day, which meant he would find some mechanical reason why the airplane wasn't good enough to fly. But he would fly at night all the time. Mm-hmm. And usually if a guy is scared or something like that, he won't fly at night. So nobody picked up the idea that he wasn't really going over the beach, because at night you flew in A4s in those days. He was not a section lead, so he was following a guy who was the section lead,
mm-hmm.
and the section lead would turn on a single tail light, a really tiny little light on his tail, and that's the only light that you had. So you'd fly around behind the leader on this one little light, and believe me, talk about vertigo. You can get vertigo real easy that way.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, that's the way we would fly together at night. We'd join up with the lights on over the ship. Then everybody would douse their lights, except for the leader would turn on the tail light, and then you would fly very close to him and watch that tail light all the time. And then when you got to the target, we'd use flares to mark targets with. Say if you were going to a road segment that you thought might have suspicious activity on it, you'd go up there, and then you'd drop flares, and you hope you'd catch the trucks along the road, and then you'd roll in and bomb on the flares.
Mm-hmm.
But once you released the flares, then the section broke up, and you were on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, the leader, had a suspicion that this guy wasn't there, but he couldn't prove it, and didn't know. But he just had that, you have a sixth sense that the guy was not there when you were doing your thing.
Weren't you talking, or wasn't he on radar?
Well, he's talking, but nobody's paying attention on radar because we're not looking at each other. We're looking for the enemy. And we didn't have we in A-Force didn't have an air-to-air radar.
Okay.
In fact, we had no radar at all to speak of in those days.
Hmm.
And so one day, or one night, this guy says, okay, arm your aircraft up now. Are you armed? Yes. Okay, I'm rolling in. Drop now. And the guy dropped, and his explosion was way over the Gulf.
Mm.
So he came back to the ship, went right to the CO of the squadron and said, this is what's happening. This is what I suspect has been happening all along. He's been downing his aircraft during the daytime for what we thought were reasonable mechanical issues, and then going at night, so it never raised any suspicion, but he's never been over the beach. And so they got the CO called him into his office in the stateroom and said, hey, what's going on, John? And the guy says, yep, he admitted he'd never been over the beach after that first mission. He was just scared to death.
Mm-hmm.
So they asked for his wings, and he gave them right up then.
Wow.
And he was off the ship that next day.
Wow. So for you personally, you just put fear in the background and just performed your job.
Yeah, sublimated it, I guess is what you want to call it. I was certainly very fearful that, you know, of a bad consequence, but I just didn't pay a lot of attention to it,
mm-hmm.
and tried to get myself into the fight, right, you know, to rather than letting it overwhelm me, I just tried to fight that much harder and be that much better and mm-hmm. try to get that target that much better
mm-hmm.
than I did the day before.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about what a SAM looks like in the air flying towards you. How do you get out of the way of it?
Okay, number one, when they fire them, there's a big, huge dust cloud on the ground because of the exhaust, and it was dry mostly, unless it was the wet weather season, but it was dry a lot. So you see this big plume, and you'd see these things take off. And that was one of the things that we always said, don't fly over an overcast or anything like that, because the SAMs, you couldn't see the SAMs take off, and one of your best visual cues, best defensive measures was a visual cue. And when it got airborne, it was like a big stovepipe, but it traveled really fast. It accelerated really fast to its Mach 2 or 3, whatever the speed was, but it was a very fast muzzle. And it had a kind of like a rooster tail in behind it. So it was bright, and you could see it. But it Hollywood, and of course it was the Fan Song was directing it to you as the controllers in the console was directing it to you for an impact kill.
Mm-hmm.
And when you saw them, then we had derived defensive measures, which was basically you dove toward to meet it, and then you started spiraling because it could not turn real fast at that speed in very small fins. It was not a fast-turning missile.
Mm-hmm.
So you would want to get it to try to change its direction. And as soon as you got it to change its direction, then you go the other way, which continued in your spin or your barrel roll, if you know what a barrel roll is.
Mm-hmm.
You would get it to change its directions, and then it would usually pass you because it just couldn't meet you in all your all the angle shifting that was occurring. And so that's how you ended up beating it.
So you would actually literally dive toward the missile.
Yeah, you dive toward it, and then you go, if you kind of think of a line of sight, of a single line of sight, you would dive around it.
Okay.
And sort of roll around it, and it's called a barrel roll.
Yes.
And
okay.
You try to get an angle, you first pointed at it, and then you separated yourself on like 15 degrees, and then you started your barrel roll. And so you're wider than the line of sight, and you kept expanding your thing, so it made it really hard for him to change direction,
mm-hmm.
and you defeated it that way.
How could you do this at night?
Well, you can see those things at night the same way.
Right.
And, in fact, it's probably easier to see them at night because they, you know, it's such a huge contrast of the flame coming out of the missile. It's very, very bright. And you do the same thing at night. You look at it, point toward it, take your offset, and start rolling, barrel rolling down.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could barrel roll up. Like, I got shot at light in the A6s a lot of times, and we were a lot lower. So when they were shot at ground level, you would do the same thing, but you'd climb and do a barrel roll around it so you wouldn't impact the ground because
mm-hmm.
there wasn't any place to go
right.
down. You had to get your vertical, which was very exciting because you were pretty generally at a fairly good speed anyhow, but you climb putting G on the airplane, which is slowing it, but
mm-hmm.
then you roll out, you're picking more airspeed up,
mm-hmm.
and you come back, and you're almost the same speed. You lose a little in the maneuver, but it's only exciting when there's two or three or more shot at you at the same time. That's when it really comes fun, and I've been through that too.
Okay, tell me
well,
about
you
that.
Well, you know, it's you get the one with the most obvious lethality toward you, and work on him, and then you shift to the next guy. So you get one of them moving, and then you try to get the next one moving. and fortunately, I was successful. But I had some real near misses in A6s. I get because I was flying low a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But in A4s, I didn't feel that they got close to me nearly as much because I had altitude and I was able to work it.
Mm-hmm. Was this a common occurrence? This happened almost every mission, or was this how often did it happen?
I wouldn't say every. I've got I don't know. I wrote down. You know, I've got a log with every one of my missions, and I say that my every time we went in the Hanoi area and about every time we went in the Haiphong area that we had some threat. Well, some of the threat would be the Fanfong would go on, but they wouldn't shoot the missile. But anywhere around Hanoi, they usually fired.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say maybe, I don't know, it's hard to say, maybe 10 missions out of 50 in 66 were Iron Hand, and probably 8 out of those 10, something fired at me.
Okay.
And in the A6s was when I was doing it, we were doing it at night by ourselves. We got fired at a lot, but it wasn't an Iron Hand mission per se. It was
right.
just going up there.
Right.
Funny.
How successful were you all in hitting your targets there in 66?
I'd say we were very, very successful. Damage areas. Now that's on point targets, but I'd say we were very unsuccessful in knocking out individual trucks or individual bridges on a road recce, per se. We could do some damage, but accurate weapons, number one, nothing like what they have today. And I would say it was basically generally ineffective for a road recce on a small target like a truck.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we did get some. The one I was on with Dave Griggs one time was at night, and well, it was actually right at dusk, and he was flying low, and there was a triple gun sight, a nice concentric series of concentric circles right around a director, and he was being shot at a lot lower. I was way up on top, and I was just on the perch, as they call it,
mm-hmm.
perfect position to make a run, and I ran in with all my bombs and put six of them right in the middle of those holes, and there wasn't anything left. So I know I must have killed at least, number-wise, probably the most kills I made in Vietnam that I know of. Those guys were actually firing and loading and all that stuff, and
mm-hmm.
and there was nothing left after I hit it.
Mm-hmm.
That one, I really felt good about.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ken, you had an incident,
a close call.
You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I had, I was... so-called shot down, but I shot myself down. It was, a fellow before me, Al Carpenter, day before, had gone out and we had carried a 2.75-inch rocket in a pod, a 19-shot rocket pod, and they would ripple fire. When you fired them, you'd fire it once, and they'd ripple all out.
Mm-hmm.
So 19 of these missiles were going out in very short sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't a terribly effective weapon, but we had to carry them anyhow. And they were pretty drag. They induced a lot of drag on your airplane, so they made you real slow. So they weren't a favorite of ours, but we had to use them anyhow because that's what we were assigned to drop or use. And the day before I had my experience, Al Carpenter was flying along, and he fired his weapon, and then he started... His engine started chugging, and he thought he'd been hit by AAA.
Mm-hmm.
He got back close to the ship, but he didn't have enough power to get aboard, and so they told him to eject, and he ejected right near the ship, and they picked him up. And the next day, and of course, he came in and debriefed that situation, thinking he had been shot down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the next day, I went out with and it turned out to be the exact same lot number, ammunition lot number, that I fired my rockets, and all this black cloud of crap came whizzing by my cockpit as
mm-hmm.
soon as I fired. And right as soon as the black stuff had departed, I heard my engine go, oh, boom! And then it started rumbling, and I knew that I had ingested some of this crap in my engine,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't going to make it because I was losing power.
Mm-hmm.
So I pointed out to sea, and I got out to the Gulf, and I was just praying that I told my wingy, who was with me, I said, just protect me from these the sampans, because there was a lot of fishing boats and stuff
mm-hmm.
that would pick these pilots up and take them back.
Right.
And they would get a reward or something. So I said, well, keep those guys off of me. And by that time, my engine was conking out and didn't have any power, so I'm not sure he even heard my message, but I thought I was talking to him.
Uh-huh.
But I went through all the procedures getting ready for an ejection because I was on a slow decline, and I know my engine was probably putting out 60% or something. It was failing, and I knew I was going to go in the drink. So I waited until I was down as low as I jumped when I was at parachute training, which is 1,200 feet,
mm-hmm.
and ejected at 1,200 feet, knowing that I felt that I could, if something was wrong, I could manually pull my ripcord and all that stuff. But it worked like a charm. Came out of the airplane, and I apparently hit the seat I was probably at just the perfect apogee, if you will, to go vertically
mm-hmm.
in my ejection seat. When I came out of my ejection seat, it still was rocket powered, so it was a little bit above me, and it came down and hit me on the way back.
Hmm.
But I didn't even know that at the time. I just felt something hit me.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, I have burns on my hand. So that was, we summarized that the fact was these little powder burns were caused by that jet, that seat hitting me. on the way down. Well, anyhow, I got in the water and got very was careful because it was such a beautiful day that I was worried that the parachute lines were all around me. And one thing you don't want to do is get entangled in your parachute because once it fills with water, it's like an anchor, and it'll just take you down.
Mm-hmm.
So you first thing you do is make sure, you inflate your own survival gear, your vest, and then I started cutting all these lines and separating myself from this parachute.
What was the temperature of the water?
Pardon me?
Do you remember the temperature of the water? Was it cold?
Oh, it was warm. It was like the bath water.
Huh.
Yeah, Tonkin Gulf bath water in the middle of the summer.
Could you see land?
No.
Okay.
I was beyond sight of land.
Okay.
I did see junks, but they were off at a distance.
Okay.
But, or fishing boats. And,
Ken, let me ask you, how long did you have coming down in your parachute? Was it 15, 20 seconds, or?
A very short period of time. I wouldn't even, maybe a minute and a half or whatever.
What were you thinking when you were coming down slowly?
Well, I was going through all the procedures, just like an aviator. You go, have all these procedures. Okay, get ready to descend into the water. Okay, inflate your life vest. Poof, you pull the lanyards on your COT cartridges.
Uh-huh.
You get ready for the water entry. You get your, all the stuff that goes through your mind, and you're getting ready to make a good water entry. And then you're going through in your own mind, okay, what do I do after water entry? Okay, you reach up and disconnect your risers from the parachute from your torso harness and get away from the risers and, all that stuff. Then you got to get your lifeboat, pull your lifeboat close to you and all that stuff because it's in a pack below you.
Mm-hmm.
And all that stuff. So it's a matter of rope procedures, and you're just going through mentally in your mind. So you don't have time to think and look. I did look out there and notice how pretty it was, but other than that, I noticed my wingman was circling around me. I did notice that.
So okay.
I had enough time to take in the view, if you will,
uh-huh.
and see. But I wasn't in the water very long and got the risers off and got my boat filled up and started getting in that, and just about the time that I was in it, the first helo came by, and I saw him. I saw these splashes out underneath the helo, and I said, "What's that?" And so he came up, and he had a swimmer in the water in a matter of seconds, and I said, "I'm fine. I can, I can do everything." We yelled over the noise of the helo, and they hooked me up and pulled me in. And when I got back in the helo, I said, of course, first of all, they want to know who you are, and so they call in and tell them who they've got. And then I said, what was all that splashes that I saw as you were making your approach? And he said, we had just taken off from the ship, so we were heavy in fuel, and we had to get rid of all of our ammo, so we would be down to weight, so we could come in and make the pickup of you.
Wow.
So. They traded 200 pounds of ammo for 200 pounds of Ken Gray.
That's a good thing.
But it was kind of neat.
Uh-huh.
And then I was taken back to the destroyer, and since I had had my hand was injured a little bit, I had it dressed and said, "Well, do you want to go back to carrier tonight?" It was late in the afternoon at that time. I said, "Now, if you don't mind, I'll spend the night with you guys." So I spent the night with the destroyer and came over the next day.
And I'm sure they debriefed you on what happened.
Well, through the debrief, we finally made the connection that two planes down and loss of two airplanes due to faulty ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
And you all didn't shoot that kind of rocket anymore, I assume.
Oh, of course not. Yeah. We threw that whole lot number probably overboard the next day or something. I'm not sure, but... anyhow, it went out to the, we sent when something like happens, you send a message to the fleet saying, "Don't use lot number umptium."
Right. Well, are there any other incidents, Ken, that you can remember from the 66 cruise that happened in the air during any of your missions?
Well, I one mission is kind of neat. because it was, I think it was Mother's Day or something, but I hit a bridge. We had a pitcher before and a pitcher afterwards, and I nailed a bridge right smack, got a beautiful hit and broke this bridge in two.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent it, I got the before and after picture, and I sent it back to Sandy and gave it to her for Mother's Mother's Day or something. I forgot what, Valentine's Day or something, but that's...
That's great.
Yeah, so... But the missions were interesting. The bigger ones were always more interesting because we were always going against more concerted fire. So those, you know, I like to go on those.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to use my iron hand skills. So those were always exciting missions.
Mm-hmm.
The road recce were exciting enough, but not. I didn't feel they were terrible productive. I don't know what to say other than it was, every day was an exciting day. Just
how many missions did you fly a day?
Normally two to three.
Okay. That's a hell of a lot of work in one day.
Well, it was, but when you were doing cyclic ops, you weren't always flying over the beach. Sometimes we had tanker hops where you carry a buddy store.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them were over the beach, and you know, we stupid aviators love to fly, and so that was great. If we get off the ship, we felt we were lucky.
Mm-hmm.
The other guys never got off the ship.
Yeah, Ken, what was your impression of the North Vietnamese, of the enemy?
Well, I thought they were very resourceful, very determined. They worked like beavers. To repair any damage we'd do on a road segment, they would have done probably in hours. So it was kind of like pissing into the wind sometimes, because you felt like that whatever bomb craters that you might have put in near their road segments or whatever you were doing, they would have it repaired in quite a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
We hit some junks on the rivers. And any time when you could see a visual impact of damage, like a bridge going down or a building going up or a direct hit on a truck or something, you got a vicarious thrill out of it because, hey, you felt like you're really doing something. But unfortunately, many of those missions were you come back to the boat and say, well, I did this and I dropped some bombs at this road approach or whatever, and you kind of said, well, duh. You know, kind of thing. It wasn't exciting. It wasn't.
Right.
You didn't feel it was terribly worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. What was the quality of intelligence that you all had? Did you feel it was good?
Generally not.
Why not?
Number one, at those days, we had all the the satellite cameras, but the authorities at the time would not allow any of that camera stuff to be used for tactical missions. So it was all strategic in those days. So we didn't have any good, we had RA-5s from other ships. We didn't have them on our ship, but RA-5s were big photo birds. And our ship had F-8 photos.
Mm-hmm.
And our F-8 photo guys would make runs across various parts of the country and bring back rolls and rolls of film. And the PIs would go through it, and we'd try to find targets in that process. And that was one way we got targets. But we never got any good satellite photography. I don't think the targeting was, target intelligence was very formulated very well. Didn't have a good system to exploit it. In fact, later on when I was in A6s, I made a recommendation to correlate all that stuff and break the country down into sections and have one guy assigned to that one little section and make him the expert for life in that one little area, so that he knew, he could tell when a leaf moved. He could tell that a truck had moved or something had moved or a fuel thing had been put in, because you can see the telltale evidence of dirt moving and all that stuff. So, no, I didn't think the intelligence was all that good. I think the intelligence from a standpoint of a MIG activity, that was excellent. We knew exactly when the MIGs were operating. We knew when they took off. We knew all that kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. we got very good air intelligence mm-hmm. stuff. But ground bombing intelligence, I think, was marginal.
Okay. Tell me about, what you viewed in 1966 as that cruise ended, and actually during the cruise, your opinion of the progress of the war, and how you all were being told to wage that war.
Well, we basically, all of us felt, I think, that we were carrying one hand behind our back because of the rules of engagement. And I believe this to this day, and nothing has convinced me any differently from anything else I've read. It's just these rules were some of them were humanitarian in aspect, trying to save innocent lives, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But others were, just seemed to me, where we lost the idea of what war is about. If we're going to commit and get our own guys killed, then we ought to extract a equal and greater cost to the enemy for that. And I don't think we traded our lives very well at all.
Hmm.
But we lost too many people on ineffective and worthless missions and didn't hurt the enemy enough.
How did that affect morale in the squadron?
Well, everybody was very, I would say, generally speaking, we're not very happy.
Mm-hmm.
But we also knew that we had nothing to say about it. It was not something that, now remember, I was a junior lieutenant at the time. Most of my friends were in that same category.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't feel we were in a position to other than grouse about it. And the leadership had groused. Had been told to shut up, including John McCain's father and others who had were over there, and they were just told that this is the way it's going to be done, in spite of the suggestions and recommendation from higher authority by people who knew how to prosecute a war, but they weren't listened to. McNamara knew too much.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about life on board the Roosevelt during that cruise. What was it like?
Well, it was good. It was a good ship. We had a great commanding officer, a fabulous commanding officer, and the morale of the ship was very, very high.
Mm-hmm. Who was your CO?
Harry Southworth.
Okay.
The CO of the squadron, you mean? Or the ship?
Or the ship. You said the...
Talley, George Talley.
Okay.
He was later an admiral and just a wonderful, wonderful man. One of the best.
So he set the tone for
yep,
that mission.
Of course. The CO always sets the tone, and
uh-huh.
he set a good one.
Okay.
He almost had a heart attack. Not a heart attack, but he had some kind of a breakdown. It was sort of like he needed sugar all the time, and I think he had maybe a diabetic type of attack.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't getting much sleep at all because we had flight operations all day long, and then we'd rearm at night, take on fuel and rearm.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on day after day after day. And the COs of these carriers were just dead.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were just hammered. Very little sleep did they get.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all catch a nap here, catch a nap there. And over time, it just really must have gotten to them.
Yeah.
But he was a great guy, and the ship did very well. We lost a screw in the Tonkin Gulf, and it cost us one of our line periods. So we only had essentially three line periods, and that cost us a lot of flight time
mm-hmm.
because we had to go up to Japan and get the screw replaced in the naval shipyard there.
Mm-hmm. What would you all do for entertainment on board? How would you entertain yourselves?
Well, there wasn't much entertainment, let me tell you, because we were so busy.
Yeah.
Day in and day out, we were very, very busy. And the only time we had entertainment was when we got into port. And
mm-hmm.
that was, we had great parties at Subic Bay. Subic Bay was a wonderful place to let your hair down. And
mm-hmm.
and in those days, they had at Cuby Point, which was the air station, they had a club that could only be described as coming out of South Pacific. It was one of those things. It was almost a Nippa Shack, but it wasn't. It was a Quonset hut, and it was wild, wild, wild west. And drinks were Kubi specials, I think, were a dime or 15 cents a piece, mm-hmm. maybe a quarter. Beers were a dime.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could go up there and get really hammered for no money at all.
Right.
And the doggone Kubi specials tasted so good. They were a mixture of all kinds of nice juices, like mm-hmm. papaya and mango and pineapple and stuff. And they laced them with, with rum.
Mm-hmm.
So you never tasted the rum, and being it was so hot and wasn't air conditioned in this place, that they just tasted so good. You'd drink about six of them before you knew what hit you. But anyhow, it was great, and we had great parties there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't participate in the gambling aspect, but I saw some Klondike games there in that QBO club, the old QBO club that people lost their mortgages, their house, and some even lost their wives over it, I'm sure. But, I mean, there were some wild and very expensive Klondike games that people were betting. Mm-hmm. And they added a lot of, unfortunately or fortunately, there gets to be an attitude when you're getting shot at day after day that you start to get a feeling it doesn't make any difference. What I do today doesn't really make any difference
mm-hmm.
because day tomorrow I may not be around, so
right.
So some people really, let it go.
Mm-hmm.
I never was in that thing. I like to observe, but I didn't like to partake. But I can say I did like those QB specials. But mostly I left before I was not under control.
Right.
And they used to have a thing that it was sitting on the side of a hill, and it was in two steps in this. This big long quinta that was sort of built in two steps, one higher than the other.
Mm-hmm.
And you've probably heard of the old catapult shots.
Mm-hmm.
And they would get a couple of these tables together, and that would be the carrier. And then a bunch of guys would get a guy and then throw him onto the table. And then, of course, they'd slosh the table down. And their job, there would be people on the other table to either catch him or help him arrest himself. And if they didn't care much for him or he was too drunk, they just let him slide all the way through. And he didn't make the arrested landing.
Right.
And so they throw these guys from this upper level right down onto this table full of beer and sliding, slishing down this table. And if he stopped too many injuries occurred, they finally had to do away with this. And when they made the new O Club, they made a very safe catapult thing, but the new guys never knew how dangerous and how fun to watch this other event was, because it was hilarious. It was just as funny as can be, but it was a little bit dangerous.
Uh-huh. Now, were you ever thrown down?
I might have done it once. Uh-huh. I think probably everybody did it once, but uh-huh. only the guys who got, I think, smashed a lot. There are other fellows that always find somebody to be the victim,
mm-hmm.
and I maintained myself such that I could keep somebody from allowing me to do it again.
Right.
So, no,
right.
I think I might have done it once to
right.
say that I've done it, but I never let it become a habit.
How much contact did you have with Sandy? Did you write her? And did she
I wrote
you?
Her every day.
Okay.
I really missed her, and my one form of contact was writing, and I would write every day.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how tired I was, I would write something. What I was doing, what kind of things I'd seen, or whatever.
Right. Did you tell her about how dangerous things were?
Well, I would tell her, let her put two and two together.
Yes.
But she knew it was a little dangerous. But
yeah.
Again, it's one of those things that I'd signed up for and I enjoyed doing, and she was mm-hmm. very supportive.
So how long did this cruise last? Was it a 5-month, 6-month cruise?
No, it was a 8 or 9 month cruise.
Okay.
It took over a month to get out there from Jacksonville all the way to Korea. I mean, Vietnam. It was a month. And so it was a month coming back. So when you're over there, it's only about 6 months of activity where you could be on the line. And then we spent another month in the dry dock up in Japan getting our prop fixed. So we probably had 5 months of productive activity or 4 months.
Okay.
I'm not sure. exactly right offhand, but it wasn't a full cruise as far as combat effectiveness, unfortunately.
Right.
No fault of anybody that I know of, but.
Okay. Well, Ken, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about regarding the 66 cruise?
No, just other than the fact that the CO is one of the finest COs I've ever had the pleasure to be a part of, the squadron to be a part of, and it truly was my favorite squadron of all that I was in,
mm-hmm.
including my own when I was a CO. Mm-hmm. I had more fun in that squadron than I did when I was a CO. But he just made life wonderful. His wife was great and got the girls all together, and they were a team. The men were a team, and they loved their dear Harry, and he just recently passed away. But they absolutely loved Harry Southworth. He was a wonderful guy. He was a tough fighter. Mm-hmm. He was a scrapper. He got in there and fought as hard and led as hard as anybody and was always first on target kind of guy. He was the first, in 65, he was given a Silver Star for the first successful strike on the SAM missile site, mm-hmm. which was new in 65.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just a wonderful, wonderful CO and an inspirational leader. And one of the things that he did is, after the last line pair, we got off the line. My last mission, I believe, was on December 25th,
mm-hmm.
which is Christmas, and we were off the line that night. And he closed the ready room, invited the CAG, our commander of the air wing, and invited the doc. And we opened up medicinal alcohol in the ready room, mm-hmm. and had a party.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is something when you have a naval officer who opens, has a party in the ready room, but
mm-hmm.
everybody turned a blind eye to it, and that was the most fun. The other thing we used to do is there were a couple of things he did which were really neat. Dave Griggs, this same fellow I keep talking about, made a songbook.
Mm-hmm.
So we got all these songs that we sing, and so we'd always have song fest, and it's a little bit, I guess, to the person who's uninitiated, it'd be more like the old Wild West when you didn't have very many females around.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you do? You end up singing or doing something like that,
mm-hmm.
to take up your time. But we had that going, and then he had another thing that we had a toilet in the ready room, right up at the front of the toilet,
mm-hmm.
in the ready room, and you would put a slip of paper if anybody screwed up. Did something dumb, you'd put a piece of paper with his name and what he'd done and what day and everything else. And then once a month, we'd have what we call the Whoosh Awards.
Mm-hmm.
And the whoosh is the sound of the toilet going down the tubes.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have a judge, and we'd have find out who had made the biggest screw-up.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a plunger. It was all painted up. Toilet plunger, and it had names of the guys who were the worst offenders,
mm-hmm.
and so we'd go around and they'd read off all these bonehead things people did, and then they'd vote on the worst offender who would get the Whoosh Award for that month. So every month we had a new Whoosh Award,
uh-huh.
and the guy got his name on there. And there was one fella who became his title is Whoosh Wilson, and because he was always doing something dumb, he just couldn't stop doing dumb things, and they weren't anything really serious, but they were usually boneheaded stunts, and he
mm-hmm.
so he had that, and that was a lot of great. So we had lots of those kind of ready room parties.
Mm-hmm.
Our entertainment after all fighter ops were over, we'd have a movie, and that was probably the biggest diversion away from life on the line, if you will,
mm-hmm.
was getting a. And of course, any time a movie had a lot of kills, we'd have a count of kills,
mm-hmm.
Kill count, and then of course, if there was any skin, that would get replayed over and over.
Sure.
So we could remind ourselves what a good looking woman was. But basically, it wasn't not too exciting, but it was good camaraderie,
mm-hmm.
and everybody was working hard together and doing things together, and there wasn't I don't remember much rancor at all among anybody in that squadron. Mm-hmm. It was really nice. They just really got together, and nobody. The CO is not one to make big issues about anything. If you did something wrong, he'd talk to you about it and try to tell you not to do it again and that mm-hmm. stuff. But it wasn't none of this. He didn't have a big ego. In fact, he had a very low ego, and he just loved being around people, and people loved being around him. So it was a great experience. And mm-hmm. We really had a good time at the beach, at parties up at the club, and we had dinners together and all those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Does VA-72 get together?
Yes, we do. We've been getting together every year since Al Carpenter came back from being a POW, which was in 73.
Wow. How is it seeing these guys every year?
It's just like old home week.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible. And Sandy and I just both kind of blink in amazement because the girls are just, they stepped in just like they had never been apart. And every time we get together, it's the same thing. Of course, now the women are talking about grandchildren and mm-hmm. the men are talking about golf scores or bad backs or something. But mm-hmm. But it's like, As a group, it's like we've never been apart.
Hmm. Okay. Well, Ken, anything else you want to touch on before we...
No, I'd say that's about it. It was just a very rewarding period of my life.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go ahead and stop for the day then.
Okay.
Thank you.